The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. If you're enjoying the show, head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to join the folks who make The Sewers of Paris possible and to get some rewards for backers. Hello, I'm Matt Baum, and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. My guest this week has been on a wild adventure ever since high school. André, also known online as Jigglypuff Daddy, grew up in a small German village and found queer friends online, eventually leaving home to move in with his internet boyfriend in Berlin the day after he graduated from high school. And eventually, they got married. It was a risky move that paid off, and he's hoping that his latest venture, dropping out of grad school to become a Twitch streamer, will pay off too. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a quick thanks to everyone who supports The Sewers of Paris on Patreon. And just a reminder that I've got a weekly newsletter for all the stuff that I'm working on. You can sign up at mattbaum.com. Each week, you get a little sneak peek into upcoming projects, little bits of fun, weird cultural artifacts I've uncovered, and of course, links to cute animals. And I hope you join me for regular live streams throughout the week at a new time. I stream games and laid-back chit-chat at twitch.tv/mattbaum every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday evenings, now at 5 p.m. Pacific. And over on YouTube, I do Saturday live streams where we comb through old news archives, searching for fun, weird artifacts. Last week, we found evidence that the "in this economy" joke was invented by a lesbian in New York in the 1970s. Come join me at youtube.com/mattbaum for those news archive hunts. Now, here's André. Well, this week, I'm speaking with Jigglypuff Daddy. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
I want to say the concept of gaming.
Okay. Gaming in general. How did that come into your life? Or was it just like always there?
It has always been there, but I still very, very distinctly remember the first time I felt that there was something special about video games and about the medium.
Okay.
And that was me, 6 or 7 years old, in the back of my parents' Jeep, driving through the night with the outside lights, no light in the car, trying to play Pokemon Gold on my Game Boy Color.
Now, was that back in the day when there's no backlight and you had to like wait for something to illuminate the screen?
Yes, it was. I was waiting for every street light, and I live on the countryside. So we were in between villages most of that time with no street lights.
Oh, boy. Okay, so a little challenging, kind of a difficult time to play. What was it about like that time that you were like, this is my thing? Like, this is important enough that I need to focus more of my attention on it.
And I think it's just that at that age, you already realize when you're queer that there's something unusual about you, even if you can't put it into words yet. So when you discover video games, you get that completely new sense of escapism that traditional media can't give you. So even in the little child brain, there's already some connection there that this lets me be whatever I want to be and escape to completely different worlds.
What did you find yourself discovering that you wanted to be in through games?
I'm not so sure, honestly. That was before I realized what oppression was, what prejudice was, before anyone was giving me any hate for the way I was. Well, except for being chubby, which I was bullied for a lot in elementary school. Mm-hmm. But it just, there was this feeling that something was wrong. And the first time you get a game where you create essentially your own character and go on your own adventures in a near perfect world. I mean, especially my first game that really touched me being a Pokemon game. That is such an idealized place. 10-year-old kids go on worldwide adventures, defeat international crime syndicates. And everything's just perfect. It's a safe world.
Do you remember like the kinds of characters that you felt a connection to?
I think a lot of it early on was me mistaking sexual attraction for connection before I knew what being gay was.
So well, yeah, it's a kind of connection.
Yeah. Like it was a lot of like any game and also like any TV show and stuff that had like muscular shirtless men. I was like, okay, that's for me. That is for me. Mm-hmm.
So what do you recall? Like, so Pokemon probably isn't one of those, but like, what do you recall
actually Pokemon is one of those. Some of those gym leaders were muscular and had their shirts off.
Okay. Okay, that makes sense. And you mentioned that you were growing up in like a small village, right?
Yes, I grew up on the German countryside. Mm-hmm. And it's a very boring way to grow up. Like I lived on a mountain. A village of 2,000 people. So you can imagine there was nothing there. There was nothing to do.
It must have been a really beautiful place, but I can also see like as a kid, like that kind of grows old fast.
It is absolutely beautiful. When I go back now, I always I realized that in ways that I did not growing up there, that I wasn't able to appreciate it. And whenever I take my husband, when we drive up to the village, especially in winter when it's snowing, he's just in awe.
What was there, like, in that village, like, were you the only gamer? Were there other kids who were into Pokemon and other games like that?
There were definitely some people in, like, elementary and high school, but I was always very much a bullied, excluded kid. Like, I actually moved schools multiple times. I skipped a grade in elementary school, so that kind of broke apart all the friendship connections that I had, because you're suddenly surrounded by completely different people. Then I was bullied a lot for my weight. I ended up switching to an entirely different school in fourth grade. And then the way the German educational system is, the first 4 years are in elementary school, and everything after is just in high school. There's no middle school in between or anything. So when I moved on to high school, was the first time I kind of had friends. And there was, video games facilitated a lot of that. Video games really helps people find each other.
Tell me about the games that you found like you had in common with other people.
There was a lot of getting together to play Zelda games, which ironically are not even multiplayer games. It was just one person played at a time and the others were watching. And Pokemon, always a through line, because it's such a game set on connecting people. It's literally a core game mechanic that you have to trade with other people to be able to finish your game.
So you mentioned it being good for like getting, like if you're introverted or shy, like getting over your social anxiety. Is that what you found? Like, did you come into high school feeling like anxious about other people and gradually opened up?
I didn't necessarily open up all that much. There was definitely some of that, but it's one of the ways I've always coped with my social anxieties and all the baggage that comes with that, that I still have. But video games are a main way I combat that to this day. Like, that's what Twitch is for me.
Yeah, well, so what was the climate even like for gay students or for queer students where you were? Like, a small village and in Germany, which I don't even know, like, what the overall kind of what the general attitude towards queerness would have been.
I was the only one. I was legitimately the only out queer student that had ever been at my school at that point. Mm. Not just at that time, but ever. Mm.
So you were like fully out, or was that just something? Was that something that you did deliberately or by accident?
Deliberately. I could tell that it was a safe environment to be out in. Like you pick up on how much like ambient queer phobia there is. And I could tell that it wasn't so much an issue of people hating queer people as much as just there not being a lot around. So I came out at 16 in high school. That was year 10 or 11. And I was actually already with my boyfriend, who I later married at that point. And we got married while I was still in high school.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, let's talk about that. So first of all, what made you feel like that was the right time to come out?
I just wanted to be myself. And at that point, it was just, I didn't want to continue having to dance around the topic. Mm-hmm. And I felt safe enough personally to come out. I know a lot of other people did not for various reasons. I knew my family would not necessarily be supportive, but they wouldn't turn on me for it. And I knew that I'd be safe at school. So one day I just decided that was, oh my God, I'm going to out myself as being pretty young here. That was on Facebook. I came out on Facebook.
Okay. What did you say?
I came out on Facebook when I was 16, and then it just traveled. It took like a week to travel around school. Mm-hmm. And for the first like 2 or 3 days, you could really tell that people were talking behind my back. You could see like the girls snickering when I came into the room. But once everyone knew, it was just a fact of life. And it was surprisingly a smooth experience.
You mentioned that you wanted to do that because you didn't want to be closeted. You wanted to be honest about yourself. Like, did you feel like there was, pressure before you came out, like pressure to keep the secret, or what was really keeping you in?
I think it was just convenience. And at some point I just decided that I wanted that to change. I wanted to do what I felt was the right thing for me. And I think I was probably informed by a lot of media around that time, because that was 2010-ish, when a lot more like mainstream TV and stuff started having more openly queer characters in them. Well, mostly gay men in side roles, but you know, more than before.
What do you recall? Like, who were the role models you had?
I'm kind of embarrassed to admit it, but a big one was Glee.
Okay. That, you know, it came along at the right time for a lot of people. And yeah, that's one of those shows, like, looking back, you're like, oh, was that? Why was that?
Yes. Oh, my God. I've noticed there's kind of been a bit of a renewed interest in it, like, in the last year. A lot of video essays on YouTube and stuff. And that show was wild.
It was a real weird one. Like, for folks who somehow aren't familiar with it, like, what do you recall, like, that drew you into that show at the time?
So let's set this up for people who just really do not know what it is. So Glee was a show set in high school. It was a dramedy on Fox, I believe, about a show choir in high school and the various diverse kids that were in it. So if you just looked at a picture of the cast, you'd really see a lot of diversity there. They had disabled characters. They had various ethnicities and races. They had queer characters. Unfortunately, a lot of those were very much sidelined. But as a 15, 16-year-old queer kid who's only really seen himself at that time in obscure gay shows that were running on like channel 420 at night, that was mind-blowing. Like, there was a gay kid on there. I think the character's name was Kurt, portrayed by Chris Colfer, who was just this flamboyant teenage gay guy who was just very open about his sexuality, who didn't take crap from anyone about it. And I think I wanted that. I think I wanted to live that fantasy.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. It is sort of one of the things that I find challenging about some Ryan Murphy shows is the amount of wish fulfillment that is going on in the world building. But if you do have a, I don't know, close identification to one of the characters, I mean, this is what you're saying about Pokemon too, is that you felt like it was an idealized world. And there you've got an idealized character who's, you know, still got problems, but fairly living a fairly, I don't know, a life that is, I think, a goal for a lot of people. That must feel great.
It absolutely did. It absolutely did. And I was very lucky that I could get a lot of that in real life. Like, I came out, I was largely accepted. I sang in high school. I did lead roles in plays. So I was pretty much just doing exactly that. I was just living Glee without the crazy plot twists.
What was it? Was it broadcast like in English or like with subtitles or was it dubbed?
Everything in Germany is always dubbed. We dub everything. And I really, really hate that. But, you know, when I was 15, it wasn't that big an issue. But I remember even back then, we get everything a year too late, in large part because of the dubbing. So I was on season 2 or 3, while most of my friends were on season 1 or 2. That were airing in Germany. So even back then, there was a kind of a time-shifted way we experienced that because I was already very much living on like the English parts of the internet and I was pirating the show.
Yeah. Tell me about like the internet life that you were having. You said like living on the English part of the internet. So like where would you go and where were your friends?
So I found internet forums for gay teens very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And looking back, a lot of those were some very messed up places where some very bad stuff was encouraged. And a lot of people who were way older than they should have been were in those spaces. But I did learn a lot there. And in addition to the mainstream media representation of queer people that was increasing at that time, that's definitely where I found like my community. And, oh, hey, gay people exist. We are a thing. And it's okay. There's a lot of us.
Were there people who were like at least somewhat close to you? Or was it like totally overseas?
Nobody was close to me at all. At all. But I think that's just a me issue rather than a general thing, because I've always been drawn to international online communities.
So are you like sharing with them like, oh, I'm getting to this part of Glee, and they're like, oh yeah, we saw that 2 years ago?
That definitely happened. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I quickly learned, oh, online torrents exist. And I quickly learned how to use them. Mm-hmm. And then those things did not happen again. But yeah, you definitely notice if you grow up in a country like Germany, that's like very much a developed country and it's often seen at the forefront of much culturally and economically. But you still notice that you're always a step or two behind what's going on in America and in the English-speaking world. And you don't really realize that until it just hits you at some point when you grew up.
Yeah. Yeah. Was there a moment when that did hit you? A moment when you were like, oh my God, I'm like more cut off than I should be.
I think it was when I started getting into like a lot of Japanese culture, into anime and manga and all that stuff, and into a lot of Japanese music. Because a lot of that stuff would just never even make it to Germany at all. Like sometimes it would make it to America, but Germany, like we got like the 4 or 5 biggest shows in the world, and we were 4 or 5 years behind. That's when I realized, oh, hey, maybe there's a larger world out there to connect to.
Now, you say that you're pretty cut off, but you also, when you came out, I think you said you were already with your boyfriend at that time. Was that somebody in your town or was that someone on the internet?
I met my boyfriend, now husband, online. And back then, he actually lived pretty far away. He lived in Berlin, where I live now.
Okay.
So for the first 3 years of our relationship, that was completely long distance, with us meeting like 3 or 4 times a year when we could.
Oh, wow. How did you actually meet?
We actually met on OkCupid, which I should not have been on at that age. But we met there, and first time we actually met in person was on a school trip to Berlin, which was just serendipitous.
So how long had you been going out at that point?
At that point, we had known each other for definitely over a year. I'm not sure about the exact timeline anymore because it is so far back now.
You must have been very excited that the school trip to Berlin was happening.
It was just perfect. It was. And at night, I snuck out of the hotel and that's what you got.
Wow.
I feel like that's the kind of stuff that a lot of like queer people grow up doing, though. You always got to do weird, risky stuff that like straight people don't have to do to have a romantic life.
So tell me about like organizing this secret meetup with your internet boyfriend. Like, so you find out your school's doing a trip to Berlin, and I assume like you frantically make plans with him to actually meet in person for the first time?
Yes. So, I mean, obviously I knew for a while when I'd be coming, which days and stuff. The moment we had figured out where the hotel was, he was pretty much on standby, ready to come anytime I knew I'd be free to sneak out. We were in a motel right next to the center of the city. And one night, there was no security. We were 17, 18-year-olds at that point. So they kind of let us do whatever. Like, as long as we were there in the morning, they didn't care. So at night, when we were done with the daily activities at like 7 or 8, I was just like, okay, bye, everyone. I'm going to see my boyfriend now.
Okay, so you didn't like make a huge secret out of this?
No secret at all. I later found out that our first kiss was actually watched by a bunch of my classmates.
Oh, okay. Wait, where did you meet up?
We met up in front of the in front of the hotel.
Okay, so you meet up in front. Everyone's like staring out the windows at you.
Yes, I later found out that they had turned off the lights in the room, so I wouldn't know they were watching. So they were all apparently just staring at us.
Now, as you mentioned, like sometimes queer people have to do things that are a little more risky than either they should or they should have to. And obviously, like meeting someone from the internet at that age can be a bit of a risk. And you even said like some of the people on the youth forums were not of an age that they should have been.
There were definitely predators there, definitely.
So how did you – like did you feel confident that like this was – and obviously it turned out for the best. But confident at the time like this is going to be okay for me to meet him?
I think as a 17-year-old, you just kind of feel like you're invincible. Mm-hmm. So it didn't hit me until years later how stupid that was of me. I mean, I'm very glad it happened looking back, but that was not smart. No adult knew where I was. Actually, nobody knew where I was once I walked away with him.
Where did you go?
First night we went to a cinema and we watched, I believe it was the David Fincher adaptation of, what is it called? The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest? Something like that.
Sure. That sounds kind of familiar.
Yes.
I don't think a romantic film, as I recall.
Definitely not.
Okay.
But I was never much of a fan of romantic comedy, so it was okay.
Okay.
And
was it like to meet your boyfriend? Like you said, you'd known each other for more than a year at that point, right?
Yeah. I was very afraid before it actually happened, but it just went completely smoothly. Like for about 10 seconds, we were probably just standing in front of each other, not really sure what to do. And then we hugged and we kissed. And after that, it was just, if it wasn't true, you'd think it was a romantic comedy, the kind of they're only making now. About young gays who are actually happy and who don't commit suicide at the end.
Yeah. So you have this like sort of whirlwind Berlin romance. And was this the first time you'd been to Berlin or had you been to the city before?
I had been to Berlin maybe twice before. Because, I mean, it is the capital, so even if you live far away, you usually end up there sometime. But I never really thought that much of Berlin before, or about Berlin, really. It's just a place that exists that I went to once when I was, like, 12. But obviously became very special very quickly.
Yeah, like, what did you see, and what do you associate now with that first time, you know, in the city with a boyfriend?
Thinking back to it, it just, everything felt like it was in a bit of a magical haze. Even I have some, I don't necessarily have distinct memories, but I have distinct memories of feelings. I remember the first time I went to his apartment and we were laying in bed, and it was dark out. It was winter, but also it didn't feel real. My memory doesn't feel real of it. It feels like it has a filter on it.
Well, I'm sure, like, it must have been, you know, like a real magical feeling for a lot of reasons. I mean, being able to be out and gay and, like, feel very, like, grown up, I assume, like going to somebody's apartment and being with someone who's independent.
We were also outside and hugging and kissing and holding hands, which, if you had told me that a year before then, that just would have seemed impossible.
So you were still in high school at that point. So you eventually go back, and what is it like after you're back in your small town? What are your feelings about that town and about what lies ahead for you?
The morning after my final day at school, I left for Berlin.
Wow.
The morning after. My husband actually came and went to prom with me. And the morning after, at like 6, we packed everything into the car and we drove to Berlin. I left prom early.
Mm. So the prom was like the last day of school for you?
Yeah, that's the way it was set up for us. Like we had, I believe we had class until April. And then in June we had prom, and then we'd like get the grades on like a separate day. But I think they were already mailing those out or doing that on digitally or something. So the day after prom, we were just, bye, I'm not coming back. I'm going to be in Berlin now, living my best queer life.
What was waiting for you there? Like, did you move in with him and just like fully, we're a couple now?
Immediately, yeah. And we're still in the same apartment. I'm talking to you from that apartment right now.
What, aside from like having a boyfriend and a place to live, what were your plans for what you were going to do in Berlin?
At first I wasn't so sure. I knew I was going to go to university for something because it was just expected. I'm an only child, and my parents desperately wanted someone in the family to finally get a university degree. Mm-hmm. So that's the direction I was pushed into. And I ended up studying Japan studies just because it seemed like fun.
What did your parents think of this? Your very swift elopement.
They were always a bit, it was always a bit, not obtuse, but it was always hard to tell what they thought about it, really. Like, the thing is, my parents, they can be a bit two-faced. They will tell you one thing, and it will be completely different from how they really feel about you. So to this day, I never quite know where I'm at with them, and it's why I'm not super close with them now. Like, we have like a Skype call once a week for like 20 minutes, but aside from that, we don't really talk. So I don't really know how they felt. Like on the surface, they were always supportive. To this day, they've always been supportive. But I saw how they treated my half brother and his first wife, who was Eastern European and Middle Eastern. And I saw the amount of racial prejudice that seeped through whenever they were talking about her. But in person, they would be so kind to her. So I just don't know if my parents secretly felt that way about me and my husband. And also, my husband is an American immigrant and Black. So I don't know how much of that might also play into it.
What was your life like? So you land in Berlin, and then is there a point where the reality of it sits in? You're like, all right, this is my life now. I got to figure out what my plan is.
There was, I think, a 6-month period between me moving to Berlin and university starting, and that was just aimless. That was just a completely aimless time. I think it's hard enough in general when you get out of high school, but if you add to that moving to another city 500 kilometers away, waiting for university to start, knowing nobody there except your partner, and also all of my high school friends, I pretty much lost contact with all of them. They all either stayed around our little village or they moved like to the next big city over. Like nobody really went far away. I was the only one.
Yeah, not to mention like your first serious relationship. I mean, you're really thrown in the deep end there with cohabitating and being in a new city, having a person in your life that you've only met in person a few times, right?
Yeah, at that point, I mean, we always had the high school vacations like 3 or 4 times a year. And usually I'd come over for like a week or two straight. So we did have significant time we had spent together. Like every
vacation
time
is very different from living together.
Yes, absolutely. At that point, we also had flatmates, which further complicated everything.
So what are you learning during that time about, like, I guess, like who you are and what kind of adult you are when you're off on your own?
I think I changed a lot. Like when you're a teenager, you have this idea of how your life is going to be and how you are going to be growing up. And I think from that time on, I slowly started to reflect on that. And I realized that like maybe I wasn't exactly the kind of person I thought I was.
Well, what kind of person did you think you were?
Like a lot of it was very like heteronormative stuff. I was very much into the whole, okay, you get married, you stay together forever, you're monogamous, you have kids, you get a white picket fence, you don't tell people you're gay really unless they ask, you don't make it part of your identity, don't be too loud, just be exactly like everyone else. I had a lot of that in me. And pretty much all of that has disappeared since.
Okay, yeah, that's the very, you know, that's what, this word is, this term is obviously very fraught, but when I hear the term straight acting, I do think of like those heteronormative ideals, you know, kind of nuclear family, post-World War II, a man and a wife and a kid and the fence and the dog, all that kind of stuff. And it sounds like that was sort of something that you were expecting for yourself.
I used to have so much prejudice about anyone who was different. Like, I used to
And that's something that you said, like, that you felt like you were the victim of, but it sounds like you were harboring some of that yourself.
Oh, absolutely. I was absolutely harboring some of that. Like, but it was very much that internalized homophobia that you direct at other gay people who are not as, accommodating to wider society. So I was very much like a slut shamer and all of that.
Okay. So that's the boy who arrived in Berlin. How did that start to change?
I can't pinpoint what it is. It's a lot of these really gradual changes. Like it has been 9 years since I moved to Berlin now. A lot of that I think was being exposed to a lot of queer content creators on YouTube and stuff who were talking about a lot of the issues surrounding our history, surrounding the kinds of prejudice that are out there that I didn't realize I had internalized. Because they're just normal.
Was there anyone in particular like you were learning from or content creators who you were like, oh gosh, that's a good point. I hadn't thought of it that way.
I'm not so sure about the earlier time anymore, but later on, when I had finally overcome some of that internalized homophobia, but I still had a lot of latent like transphobia and prejudice against other like subcultures within the queer umbrella, someone who really helped me a lot was ContraPoints on YouTube.
Oh yeah, she's great. Natalie.
Yeah, she's absolutely lovely content. She really helped me understand what, first of all, what trans identities were and what non-binary identities were, which I was like 2015-ish. I was just completely unaware of non-binary identities even existing. And when you did hear about them, it was always as a punchline on the internet, like especially in those right-wing spaces, this really nasty, just blind hatred. And I had internalized some of that, and finding creators like Natalie on YouTube, that helped me so much, especially with these long form video essays where they would both go into these issues and really illuminate them from all sides. But also where that was the first time I ever saw an out visible trans person who I could relate to and learn from and look up to. And I think that's the most important thing about representation, is that if you don't see someone represented, you're only going to take in the bias of society and the bigotry and the prejudice and the tropes that media feeds you where they're usually villains.
So what did you see yourself doing? Like after some time, maybe some years, and after watching these YouTube videos in Berlin, like what did you find yourself doing that was different from what you expected?
I've changed pretty much everything about the circle that's around me. It used to be almost entirely straight women, which I think a lot of gay kids early on, there's a lot of like straight girls around them. Especially online, there's a lot of non-binary people, a lot of trans people, a lot of queer people of color that I'm around now. And it's this much more diverse crowd with much more diverse views on the world. In my day-to-day life, I feel better about being queer, being surrounded by all of these people now than I ever did before. There was so much internalized hatred still there. For the longest time, I was like, oh, I'm fine with being gay, but I'm not like all of those.
Mm-hmm.
And now I can just say, no, I'm queer. All of these people are fucking awesome. They're all part of the family. And we're just going to be like this. And that's amazing.
So tell me about, like, as you got to the end of that, like, 6-month period where, like, college hadn't started and you're just sort of aimless, where did you start to find direction?
Direction. I'm someone who...
Or maybe you didn't initially. Like, what happened when you started going to school?
I was just about to say I didn't really find direction for long. honestly, even at university, I was very much still directionless. I got my degree after a while. I got my Japan Studies degree. Focused on mass media because that's where my interest has always been. Like, whatever I was going to do, it would have something to do with mass media. And I think that's still where I am, being on Twitch. Worked at the university. Most of my little friend circle I had at that time was fellow students. But there's kind of now a time of my life that just, it kind of went by and it feels like nothing monumental happened for a lot of it. I've realized after a while that academia was not for me while I was working on my master's degree. So after a while, I kind of just dropped out and spent...
What was your master's going to be in?
Also in Japan studies.
Okay.
I continued in the same field. I was working at the department. I was working with the European Association for Japanese Studies, which was a nonprofit that was located at my university that organized the biggest European Japan Studies conventions and stuff.
Conferences?
Conferences, thank you. I was really heavily integrated into that entire world. Like, I knew all the major professors from around Europe by name and had talked to all of them and had helped them out and all of that stuff. I was very much integrated in there. And I could have kept going, but at some point there was a deep unhappiness with both academia and with my time at that particular university. Mm-hmm. So I kind of, this was like 3 years ago, I kind of just lapsed, stopped going to classes, then at some point left. And didn't really find a direction again until I started streaming early last year.
Yeah, so tell me about that. How did streaming start?
I knew for a while that I wanted to do it. And I had been playing around with online content for years. Like, at some point, I had a pretty popular YouTube channel where I was doing K-pop videos, like music videos and stuff. But that is...
When you say do it, like making K-pop videos or reacting to them?
Like reviews, reactions, video essays, that stuff.
Okay.
I realized pretty quickly, though, that wasn't really my calling. Like, I had an interest there, but it wasn't something that I wanted to dedicate, like, years of my life to. Mm-hmm. And also, I realized very quickly that the culture in that online space can be very mean-spirited, the fandom cultures there. Mm-hmm. If you want to be a critic and do thoughtful content in that space, that kind of prevents you from doing anything. So I had to get out of that as well. That's very much the story of my life, getting out of things.
It must have been difficult, like, leaving your master's program. I mean, it's surely you'd put in a lot of work there. So did it feel a little, hard, or like you were giving something up that you might not want to give up to stop going?
I still struggle with that. There are days when I wake up and all I can think is, I made a huge mistake. Mm. Like, I could return, obviously, and continue it. But I wasn't that far into my master's. I had done, I think I needed 120 points or credits, and I had maybe 20 of them. So I was only really like one or two semesters in.
Okay. So what did you do? Like, how did you find Twitch? And at what point were you like, I want to do this?
So, like I said, already had been doing online content in some capacity for a while. It was even my living for a while there while I was doing all the K-pop stuff. So I knew I was going to go almost certainly into online content because it's something I can do from home on my own terms. I can do something that speaks to me and to my own personal interests. And I can kind of be free while I'm doing it. I don't remember how exactly I got to Twitch. I think it was just the general desire to do something about video games. And I was thinking long-form scripted content, like video essays at first. That was my initial angle. I wanted to go into like analysis and all of that good stuff, which I'm still thinking about branching out into. I adore content like that. I adore thinking about these things in very much detail, more detail than anyone probably ever should. But that's what brings me joy. But then, especially in early 2020, I started streaming just as the coronavirus pandemic hit. Mm-hmm. So everything kind of changed, and the need for community online became so enormous when we couldn't do anything in person anymore. And we didn't know how long that would last. I mean, we still don't know how long this will last. If anything, it's only gotten worse since. So I think that gave me the push to become a streamer, do it on Twitch. That's why now I go live 7 days a week, every evening, because it's a space for community. It's a space where queer people get together. And I don't think I realized how important it was for viewers until pretty recently. But it's really where a lot of people who don't have anyone to talk to in their life, who can't live who they really are where they are, it's what a lot of people go to. It's not recorded content like on YouTube or traditional TV or books. It's this live online content where you can talk directly to the person who's currently streaming.
Is this like a return to what you were doing in high school when you were finding people across the world in a tiny little village?
Definitely. 100%. It's kind of a thrill to know that, like, sometimes when I see the names of the people in my chat and it's like regulars who I know, sometimes I just think about like, okay, they're from there. There's people from 5 continents here right now. Mm-hmm. Like this sense of connectedness across the world in a time where a lot of us can't even leave our country.
Yeah, I guess we're all sort of in our own little village right now, just like either just stuck at home or some of us like unable to travel. Yeah, so you know, this is, I guess, a position that you are familiar with being in.
Yeah. I mean, I was stuck in a village and I needed connections to the world. And I see myself as being on the other side of it now, though. Like, I'm more secure now. I don't have the largest friend group here in Berlin, but the people that I do have are people that I care about and that I know will be there for me. And obviously, I have my husband. So I'm not someone at this point who needs that community. I think now I see myself as the person who provides and curates that community for others.
So what are the games that you started playing?
I went down pretty much the same route as the games that really spoke to me when I started. I started with a lot of Japanese RPGs. I started with a lot of Pokemon. And that's still what I do a lot, a year on. I have Final Fantasy Fridays. Every Friday, we just play a Final Fantasy game, like chronologically, working our way through the franchise.
Oh my goodness. That's okay. That'll keep you busy.
Oh, it really will. I'm only on the second one.
Okay. Yeah. So I don't even know, like, in Europe, because there was in the US, the numbering changed with the Final Fantasies. And I can't remember exactly how it fell, but the second one in the US was like the fourth one in Japan or something like that.
Yeah, infamously number 6 in America turned into number 3.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, but in Germany it was much simpler. The first 6 just didn't come out until after the 7th.
Oh, okay.
they were just never localized for Europe until Final Fantasy VII became this enormous hit in the late 90s, and then they slowly started bringing the old ones over.
Like, wow, that's really strange to have missed 6, because that one, I mean, gosh.
Yeah,
that, that's what I was going to say. That's what to miss out on. Oh my God, that must have been a joy for you to play the first time.
It's one of the ones that I have not actually finished that I will finish as part of my Final Fantasy Friday series. So I'm so incredibly excited to hear Dancing Mad in a video game for the first time.
There's a lot of very good. Oh my God, it's a very good game. I'm excited for you to get to play that for the first time. Eventually, like if you're only on 2, it might take you a while to get to that one.
I mean, 2 and 3 at least, and I think 4 are also pretty short. So maybe this year I'll make it to 6. I am playing once a week for like 4 hours.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yikes. Okay. That'll take you some time. Tell me about the community that's grown up. Like, how have people found you, and who are the kinds of people who join the chat?
So it's become a more and more diverse crowd as time has progressed, which I'm incredibly happy about. It started very small. I didn't have a built-in audience that I could like reroute to my streams. So the first month I was streaming to an average of, I think, 2 people. Hmm. And then it was kind of like a lot of people really explode in popularity. A lot of people kind of go from like 2 viewers to 20 viewers to 50. It wasn't that case for me. I'm still not anywhere near that level. But it was a slow climb month after month to where I now have like 20 odd people there usually. And at first it was just a few people that I knew from Twitter. And then slowly but surely it progressed into... I co-founded a queer streamer network in early 2020, which I'm sadly not with anymore for personal reasons, but that was a big part of my early trajectory there. A lot of people coming in for that, a lot of people who were looking for that exact sense of community. They were looking for queer streamers, and they found that network and the people on that network. And a lot of those people also are still around. And after that, I've gotten to the point now where it's a bit of a natural progression where I can't really tell where people are coming from anymore, but it's an incredible group. I absolutely adore my stream audience because I make a point out of providing a safe space, which a lot of queer streamers are trying to do. But on top of that, I'm very deliberate that my streams are 18 plus spaces and that we, on top of all the inclusiveness and welcoming attitude, that we're also sex positive, body positive, kink positive, and sex worker positive. And that we talk about those topics very openly as well, often on stream. So it's just wild what kind of people from all around the world, from all kinds of spaces, all kinds of identities will come together and will feel safe. Just yesterday, I had someone in my chat who essentially came out in chat as, this is a term I had not heard before, an egg. Someone who thinks they might be trans and who are starting to experiment with different pronouns and stuff. And the community is just incredibly welcoming. Like after that person said that on chat, I don't know if they had told anyone else before, but it kind of sounded like that was their first time telling anyone this. Everyone in chat just cheered them on. And it was such a beautiful thing to see. And we have that happening a lot. That's primarily what I see my streaming about bringing all these people together. And the games we play and stuff are secondary. It's primarily just a space for a bunch of people who don't necessarily have a place they can feel at home in the real world to get to at a certain time every day to talk to each other, hang out, discuss things. We are not apolitical. A lot of streamers have like rules to their chat, like no politics and stuff like that. I explicitly do not do that. We talk about all of the stuff. We get into long, deep discussions that jump from topic to topic. People can come there and they can be who they are. And I love that. That is my favorite thing about Twitch and about my community.
And tell me about your husband. And when did you get married? And what made that feel like the right time to do it?
We got married when I was 18. We were just walking through Berlin at a time where he was also struggling with his visa. So I was just like, let's get married. And we did on the 1st of November, 2012.
Yeah, wow. Is that literally how the proposal happened? Let's get married?
Yeah, we were walking down the street and I just suggested it. I was just like, hey, why don't we get married? And we did. And I'm glad we did because it worked out really well.
What kind of wedding did you have?
Very, very small. We didn't really have a ceremony. We just did the whole legal thing. So I did have some friends there, actually from my high school. There were some people, I had actually developed a small but close friend group at that time. And they had actually come to Berlin to be at my wedding, which is just incredible, which another thing that you just do not expect, like at 18 as a high schooler, that you'd be A, getting married, B, getting married in a city 500 kilometers from your home, and C, that your high school friends will come and be your... not bridesmaids, the people who have to be there to kind of...
Yeah, the wedding party.
Yes, thank you. It's those terms that I never have to use in English.
Wow. So did your life change at all with the being married, or was it just like, you know, the same relationship, just with a piece of paper?
I feel like we were already so close at that point that it didn't change anything. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, except that we call each other husbands now.
I mean, that must feel like a change, right?
It does. It's very important for me for just the symbolic meaning that it has as something that just years prior we wouldn't have been able to do and to kind of send a message to the world. But in our day-to-day life, it doesn't really change anything.
And tell me about Berlin. I imagine, like, especially in comparison to where you grew up, what kind of a city is Berlin like for a queer person?
Berlin is probably one of the queerest cities on the planet. I'm an incredibly shy person in person, and I have a lot of social anxieties to do with being around crowds and stuff. So I'm not the best person to talk to about the queer nightlife here. But that is what a lot of queer culture in Berlin is. It is all nightlife. It's clubs, it's bars. And it's not for me, but I'm very happy that these places exist and have served the community for so many years. A lot of them having been around for like 20, 30 years or more. But there's a lot of queer Berlin, but not a lot of it that very much speaks to me personally. It's not really my culture. So I haven't really intersected that much with Berlin's queer culture. I just know it's an incredibly inviting place, especially compared to the rest of Germany and to other large cities in Europe.
Yeah, that's interesting because it was something that you felt like you were lacking for a long time. But now it sounds like you really got that through your internet community.
Yeah, ironically, I moved to one of the gayest cities on the planet and I got all my gay community online.
Yeah, there's, you know, if you haven't been, there is a fantastic queer museum. I can't remember the name of it, but Berlin has an amazing queer museum with a ton of history there that I highly recommend. I was there in 2017. It was just an incredible place to be.
It's one of those places I've been meaning to go to, and it's never happened. And now with the pandemic, it is impossible right now, and I'm hitting myself for not having gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. Like when you do move to a city, like there's so many like tourist things that are actually legitimately good, and you're like, oh, but I'll do that eventually. There's no rush for me to get to it.
Yes, I haven't even done the most major museums in Berlin yet. Like I only went to some of the major museums in the city center on the Museum Island, like 2018, 2019. After 6-7 years here. And those are excellent museums. They're beautiful. There's amazing stuff there. It's just, when you live here, it goes so far down your list of priorities.
Right. Yeah, I lived in San Francisco for about 10, 11 years and went to Alcatraz once. Went to the Golden Gate Bridge like 2 or 3 times maybe. Just, you know, you don't do those. And I live in Seattle, and I think I've been to the Space Needle once. I've been inside the Space Needle. No, twice. I've been to the Space Needle twice after 6 years.
At least you've been there. I didn't go up in Berlin's TV Tower, which is, I mean, it's our equivalent of the Space Needle. I haven't actually been in there until 2018.
Okay. Yeah. What a beautiful, like, it's such a gorgeous city too. So I don't know. Like, do you have plans for like when the pandemic is over and fingers crossed that we can all go out and experience the world again? Is there stuff in Berlin that you're like, okay, now I'm actually going to do this?
Honestly, our biggest plan after so many years of Berlin is to move somewhere else for now.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Like, we've been thinking Amsterdam.
Oh, Amsterdam, also very nice. What made you want to leave Berlin?
I think it's just once you've been in a place for so many years, it loses some of its spark. And for me personally, Berlin has never necessarily had that spark. I primarily moved here for my husband. Like, I like the city, but it's not a place that I would have moved by myself. My plan out of high school was to move to London, which I wouldn't do anymore now post-Brexit, but...
Well, yeah, some challenges with that as well. Amsterdam, though, lovely. What's attracting you to that one, aside from the tulips?
I mean, the tulips help. We've been a couple times over the last couple of years, and it just... When you're there, there's a sense of just beauty and beauty everywhere that I haven't felt from another large city. Like, it almost feels like you're on the countryside, but you also have this immediate access to everything and this intense convenience. It just seems like an amazing place to live in.
Yeah, gosh, you're really making me nostalgic because I spent some time in Amsterdam as well. And like the access that you have to the city with the bikes, it's just you can get everywhere.
It's so walkable.
It's yeah.
I love walkable cities. And Berlin is kind of a walkable city, but it's just a bit too large. Like, I live within the ring, so in the center of the city. But if I want to walk to, like, the center, that's still an hour plus of just straight up walking. And I'm not going to be walking through pretty areas. I'm going to be walking along, like, large roads. It's just not the same experience as being in Amsterdam, and you walk everywhere, and it's these beautiful historic buildings, and it's the canals, and there's flowers everywhere. I think that's just something that we both want right now. And we both work from home and on our PC, so we can move around.
That's true. Like, you've got your, with streaming, you can do that from anywhere as long as you've got fast internet.
Yes. And enough space in my room.
Yeah, sure. What do you envision? Like, what is the next, I don't know, like if you're dreaming up the next like 5-10 years, what does that time in your life look like?
I have become very serious in the last month or two about in 2021 and 2022, I'm making streaming my full-time thing, aggressively working on doing this so I can essentially travel the world while just streaming 5 to 7 times a week. Mm-hmm. And being able to pretty much go anywhere I want. That was always a dream I had. And especially if you're European, at least within the EU, it's something that you can realistically do. And that's an experience that I desperately want. I want to be able to say, I feel like spending some time in Paris or Lisbon or Italy. And within a couple months, being able to like rent a place there for a while and just go there.
This, you know, to bring it back to Pokemon, this feels so much like visiting the different regions.
Oh, it does. One day we're going to need that game that combines all of the regions.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like you're jumping from Pokemon Gen to Pokemon Gen.
Really? Yeah. If only we had little electric rodents that we can catch with balls, then it would be perfect.
And life is complete at that point.
That is all I need. I'm just going to go to Italy. I'm going to catch the regional version of the rodent there, and I'm going to be happy.
Perfect. If people want to follow you online and check out your streams, where should they go?
They should head over to twitch.tv/JigglypuffDaddy, but Jiggly spelled with a Y, because I do not want Nintendo to sue me. And also the same name on Twitter, and that's where I mostly hang out. And we are a very inviting bunch. We call our brand Gay Mess, and everyone is welcome.
Fantastic. Well, I'm looking forward to spending some time in your chat, because that sounds really pleasant.
Yeah, thank you very, very much for having me. This was very fun.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for joining me. Thanks to Andre for joining me, and remember to check him out at twitch.tv/JigglyPuffDaddy. That's JYGGLY Puff Daddy. This week's recommendation is that you dive into some of the fascinating queer history of Berlin, starting with the Schulz Museum, an incredible archive of queer history. As I'm recording this, it's closed due to the pandemic, but hopefully it'll be open again soon, and if you find yourself in Berlin, you absolutely must check it out. And if that's not an option, recommendation 2 is that you read up on Karl Heinrich Ulrichs, a pioneering German sexologist who was a trailblazer when it comes to what we now think of as queer studies. There's a fantastic New York Times article about him and his legacy. Search for the headline "Overlook No More" to read it, or look for the 2015 New Yorker article entitled "Berlin Story: How Germans Invented Gay Rights More Than a Century Ago." It's absolutely fascinating stuff that you will be at turns inspired by and infuriated by that nobody told you about this stuff in school. Thanks for listening, and thanks to everyone who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/mattbound to support the show and get some fun backer rewards. Remember to join me over on Twitch every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for live stream games and chill chit-chat. That's at twitch.tv/mattbound. And sign up for my cute little newsletter at mattbound.com. Also, check out my YouTube for deep dives into queer history at youtube.com/mattbound. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Comtech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.